The Oracle Network.
Look deeper. Well, hey there, friends, and welcome back. I'm your host, Melanie Peterson, and today I've picked the case of Jane Toppin to cover for you. Jane was later referred to as the Angel of Death. She was also known as Jolly Jane during her nursing years. She was a serial killer who lived in Massachusetts during the late 1800s, and after her capture, she stated that, quote, her life goal was to have killed more people, helpless people, than any other man or woman who ever lived, end quote. And while there have been other serial killers who have killed far more than Jane, the 31 murders she confessed to and the additional 70 that she suspected of are certainly nothing to bat an eye at, and were definitely enough to instill fear into the hearts of her fellow Bostonians. She claimed the reason for murdering all these people was that the man who she was deeply in love with at 16 years old left her for another woman, and because she was single with no husband and no children and no home to look after, she needed something else to occupy her mind. And clearly murder is the best and most obvious choice for an activity that occupies your mind if marriage and children aren't a possibility. I mean, if that's how it goes, then by default I should be a serial killer, but I'm not. I just talk about them in extreme detail. Despite admitting what she had done, a jury would end up finding her not guilty by reason of insanity, and she would spend the rest of her life at Taunton State Hospital. Buckle up, my friends. This one is going to be a bumpy ride. This is Mask of Sanity. Jane Toppin was actually born Honora Kelly and went by the nickname Nora. Her parents, Peter and Bridget Kelly, happily welcomed their baby girl in 1857, and while not much is known about Jane's birth parents, we do know that Bridget unfortunately died from tuberculosis when Jane was barely a year old. Peter, her father, was, quote, said to be a chronic drunk, prone to violent outbursts, as well as a subject of quite a few colorful legends. Many say that he eventually went insane while working at a tailor shop and was institutionalized when trying to sew his eyelids shut. An alleged cousin later reported that Honora had an older sister, Nellie, who went violently insane in her 20s and had to be institutionalized, end quote. So perhaps mental illness runs in the family and was a contributor to Jane's mental state when she was older. At the age of 6, Jane and her older sister Delia were sent to the Boston Female Asylum at the urging of their father, who was known as Kelly the Crack, because he could clearly no longer care for them. The asylum's board concluded that the girls were possibly abused and, based on their appearance and personal hygiene, neglected as well. Both girls were remanded to the asylum, but the following year, Honora was sent to live with Mrs. Ann Toppin and changed her name to Jane Toppin, despite never officially being adopted into the family. The Toppins allegedly, quote, passed her off as an Italian girl whose parents died at sea because the stigma associated with the Irish, end quote. Jane's sister Delia would end up spending time in a mental institution and then turn to prostitution after her release, dying quite young from alcoholism. While going to live with an actual family seemed like a wonderful change for Jane, unfortunately it was anything but. Anne would constantly ridicule and humiliate Jane, who was there more as a servant rather than another member of the family. Jane's background was Irish Catholic, and Anne used this as a way to degrade her foster daughter since the Toppins were Protestant. The Toppins also had a daughter of their own, Elizabeth, who never participated in Jane's abuse, but Jane still resented Elizabeth because she knew that her foster sister would get the life that Jane wanted, love and positive attention, and one day married. To counter the abuse and to play it off like it didn't affect her as much as it probably really did, Jane, quote, developed a vivacious personality and denied her Irish heritage by making derogatory anti-Irish and anti-Catholic statements in the Protestant circles in which she moved, end quote. Over the next 10 years, Jane had a tendency to exaggerate and lie about parts of her life. She claimed that, quote, her father sailed around the world, her sister married an English nobleman, her brother was decorated at Gettysburg by Abraham Lincoln, end quote, just to name a few. While most of the children at her school did like her, some were irritated at her because she was constantly boastful, she made a lot of false claims. She would also avoid punishment for misbehaving by blaming other children for what she had done. Also around the age of 16, Jane met and fell head over heels in love with a man who worked in Lowell, Massachusetts, quote, who even gave her an engagement ring engraved with the image of a bird. The relationship soured when he moved to another town and fell in love with his landlord's daughter, a young woman he eventually married, end quote. This abandonment left Jane feeling unwanted and unloved. She wondered how anyone would be able to love someone like her. As Jane was nearing the end of her indentured servant contract with the Toppins, she became painfully aware that the chances that she would get married were very slim. So according to one of my sources, quote, Jane grew unattractively plump, end quote. That's probably the nicest way one can put it, can't they? But clearly she was feeling unwanted, unloved, unattractive, and like a lot of people, and myself included at times, we've turned to food to help cope with stress and feeling horrible about ourselves. So Jane seems like she did the same thing and gained a lot of weight from it. In 1874, Jane, now 18 years old, was officially released from her indentured servant duties in the Toppin household. She received the $50 that were owed to her, but she actually remained in the home for another 10 years working for her foster sister, Elizabeth, after her foster mother, Anne Toppin, passed away. Elizabeth eventually got married to a man named Oramel Brigham, a church deacon. Elizabeth was a much kinder soul than her mother, and went out of her way to make sure that Jane was treated the way she deserved to be treated, as an equal member of the household. In 1885, Jane moved out of the home, likely due to some kind of strain or dispute. It happens, families definitely argue, but she did retain a relationship with Elizabeth, who told Jane she could always come back and visit. 2 years later, Jane, quote, began nursing training at Boston's Cambridge Hospital, end quote. She was very well liked with the patients. They gave her the nickname Jolly Jane because she was always friendly and outgoing, and I think she did this in order to quench her thirst for attention. But her colleagues were not necessarily as taken with her as the patients were. She apparently had a, quote, bizarre fascination with autopsies that troubled even her supervisors, end quote, and would say things like she didn't think there was any point in keeping older patients alive. She was also not well liked by her fellow colleagues because she was known as a devious gossip and would repeatedly lie about her background just like she would do in school. Jane was also suspected of stealing, but she was never actually caught. So again, she's continuing to lie and pull the same kind of shenanigans that she did in school, but now she had an opportunity to take it a bit further. Possibly wanting to prevent feeling deserted, she would start to over-medicate or under-medicate patients that she liked so that they would have to remain under her care for a longer period of time. She also began to treat her patients like guinea pigs and experiment with different medications and in different doses than what the doctors prescribed in order to see how it would affect them. She later stated that, quote, she grew to like atropine because of the more animated symptoms that were associated with it, end quote. After Jane's arrest, she would be suspected of murdering at least 12 people during her time at Cambridge Hospital. One of her victims actually survived the murder attempt, but she didn't speak up until 1901 after she had heard that Jane had been taken into custody. Amelia Finney recalled that when she was at Cambridge for surgery, which had gone smoothly, during her recovery time in the hospital is when she had her interaction with Jane. She stated that, quote, Jane administered some bitter-tasting medicine to Amelia to help her with her pain. As she was slipping into unconsciousness, she realized that Jane had gotten into bed with her and began kissing her all over her face. Luckily for Mrs. Finney, Jane was startled by someone and hastily left the room. As Amelia gained consciousness the next day, she thought the incident had all been a dream and she checked out of the hospital, end quote. But hearing about the awful crimes Jane had committed made Amelia realize that what had happened wasn't a dream. Jane had tried to kill her and sexually assaulted her in the process. In 1888, Jane, who had been highly recommended by a few doctors at Cambridge, started a competitive training program at Massachusetts General Hospital. She completed her training and returned to Cambridge. Now, the 32-year-old Jane was more primed than ever and saw another opportunity. The head nurse at the hospital was taking a leave of absence, so Jane wiggled her way in and was named as her temporary replacement, but she was suspected by many of her colleagues for ignoring dosage recommendations and endangering many of the patients in her care. Several patients died while she was the acting head nurse, and despite her colleagues being concerned with her actions, it doesn't sound like anyone brought this to the attention of a superior who could have looked into the issue and potentially saved the lives of any number of the helpless patients under Jane's control. During the summer of 1890, 33-year-old Jane Toppin was discharged from her position at the hospital because she, quote, broke an important rule and left the ward without permission, end quote. As a result, she never received her official nursing license, although she had finished her schooling and got her diploma. After working as a private nurse for a few months, Jane actually returned to Cambridge Hospital but was swiftly dismissed in the spring of 1891 over concerns that she was endangering patients by not following dosing instructions. So instead of finding a job in another hospital, and chances are she probably wouldn't have been hired anyway since rumors of her recklessness with medications would end up following her for the rest of her life, she decided to go full-time into private nursing, which she was actually able to ease into pretty nicely thanks to recommendations from doctors to their wealthier patients. Private nursing gave Jane more freedom to be reckless since she no longer had colleagues or doctors looking over her shoulder. In no time at all, Jane was, quote, regarded as the most successful private nurse in Cambridge, even though some of her employers were annoyed with her intricate lies and petty theft. In her free time, Jane loved to guzzle beer, tell lies, and spread rumors, end quote, which would often turn her friends against each other. She gloated over everyone else. She played puppet master and really just seemed like she wanted to see what kind of damage she could inflict on others. Over the next few years, Jane would continue to administer dangerously high levels of medication to her patients, yet she seemed to fly under the radar from doctors and patients because she was viewed as, quote, a highly skilled professional, compassionate, and cheerful, end quote. But she would soon begin targeting other people besides her patients. In May 1895, 38-year-old Jane Toppin poisoned 77-year-old Israel Dunham. Dunham was her landlord and chose him because he was, quote, feeble and fussy, end quote. After his death, she moved into his home with Dunham's wife, Lovey. During the fall of 1897, Jane poisoned Lovey Dunham, but she would lay in wait for another 2 years before her next kill. And unfortunately, she set her sights on her foster sister, Elizabeth Brigham. In 1899, Jane, now 42 years old, visited with Elizabeth while they were on vacation in Cape Cod. One morning, Jane suggested she and Elizabeth go down to the beach and have a picnic, and Elizabeth agreed. So Jane packed a lunch of corned beef, taffy, and mineral water. The water had been dosed with strychnine, and Jane, quote, slowly poisoned her and claimed this was the first victim that she hated, end quote. Once Elizabeth was dead, Jane went to Elizabeth's husband, Orimel, and told him, quote, that it was her sister's last wish for Jane to have her gold watch and chain, end quote. Of course, Orimel had no clue how manipulative Jane was, and the request sounded to him like something his wife would have said and wanted, so he gave Jane the watch and chain. When Jane was arrested in 1901, Orimel found out that she had pawned the watch and chain, and that it wasn't the dear sentiment of a dead sister that Jane had originally claimed it to be. On December 29, 1899, Jane was caring for a 70-year-old woman named Mary McLear. Mary's doctor had recommended Jane for a caretaker position for Mary, but Jane would end up shortly after getting the job poisoning the woman and stealing some of her clothes. What's interesting about this murder is the fact that Jane didn't really have any kind of relationship with Mary, and Jane, aside from this one, only really tended to kill people that she knew, family members or patients that she had cared for a period of time. She had only worked for Mary for a short time and didn't know her prior to being recommended for the job, so this one was kind of an outlier. On February 11th, 1900, Jane murdered her friend Myra Connors because she wanted her job. She used strychnine, and once Myra was dead, Jane went to the theological school where Myra worked as a dining matron and spoke to the dean, telling him, quote, that Myra was planning on going on a sabbatical and she had intended to recommend Jane for the job. Jane lied to the dean and told him that Myra had instructed her on all the duties of the job, end quote. Having no reason to doubt what he was being told, the dean hired Jane, but it was pretty clear from the day she started that she had not been given any information on how to effectively do her job, which did not go unnoticed by her co-workers. Jane finished out the school year, and over the summer, she was employed by the biological school in Woods Hole and worked in the mess hall. Once the school year resumed at the theological school, Jane would actually only last until November before she was fired due to several complaints filed against her by co-workers, as well as suspicions that she had tampered with the money coming into the dining hall. During this period, Jane never actually poisoned anyone to the point where they died, but this quiet period would only last until the beginning of 1901. Jane found a home in a building run by landlords Melvin and Eliza Beadle. For what seems like her own sheer amusement, Jane poisoned them, but only enough to give them stomach issues. Her main target was the Beadle's housekeeper. Jane figured if she could poison Mary Sullivan just enough to make her appear unreliable and possibly intoxicated, that it would be enough for her to get fired so Jane could take over her job. And unfortunately, the plan worked. In late June 1901, Jane was delinquent in paying for her rent for a cottage she was staying in to the tune of $500. So the cottage's landlord, Mary Mattie Davis, traveled to where Jane was working at the Beadle's home in Cambridge. Upon her arrival, Jane gave Mattie some mineral water that she had laced with poison and further exacerbated Mattie's illness by giving her morphine later that evening. For the next week, Jane slowly poisoned Mattie to death and did it without a shred of suspicion from anyone, including a doctor who had come to examine Mattie and allegedly had previously assisted in identifying another female serial poisoner. Jane treated Mattie like some kind of sick science experiment. She would make her ill and then help her to get better before poisoning her all over again until Mattie eventually fell into a coma. By July 5th, Mattie's body couldn't tank anymore and she passed away at the time from suspected heart failure and without anyone realizing the true reason why she had died. Pretending to offer assistance to Alden Davis, Mattie's husband, Jane moved into the Davis home. Just a week later, Jane tried to burn the house down by lighting some papers on fire in a closet, but the fire was discovered and quickly put out. Jane, however, was very tenacious. She tried again just a couple days later by starting a fire in the pantry and then leaving the house to go on a walk. Some neighbors saw smoke pouring out of the kitchen window and ran to put out the fire. About a week later, Jane set another fire, but it was also caught in time and extinguished. Okay, now this is just a little crazy to me. That's three fires in a span of like 2 weeks. So why did nobody suspect Jane in starting these fires? When something bizarre or new starts happening, in my mind, you look at what the most recent change was, and in this case, it was Jane moving into the house. Unfortunately, apparently the Davises don't share the same quizzicality, if that's even a word, that I do, when it comes to suspicious events. Jane remained in the home, not suspected in setting the fires, and because she was frustrated that the fires didn't do what she intended, she turned away from that and went back to poisoning. For her first victim, she chose Genevieve Gordon. She was the youngest daughter of Alden and Maddie and had opted to remain in the family home to help keep an eye on and help out with her father. Genevieve was clearly still grieving the sudden loss of her mother and had turned to Jane for help. So when Jane poisoned her, she tried to make it look like a suicide. After Genevieve's death, Jane, quote, turned her sights on Alden Davis and killed him in less than 2 weeks after his youngest daughter's death, end quote. Just a few days after Alden died, Jane poisoned the eldest Davis daughter, Minnie Gibbs, and while Minnie lay dying in her bed, Jane took Minnie's 10-year-old son into her bed with her. It's not confirmed that she sexually abused the boy as his mother was dying, but it's highly suspected. And shortly after the last of the Davis family was buried, Jane returned to Lowell, Massachusetts on August 26th, quote, in hopes of marrying her dead foster sister's widower, Oramel Brigham. Jane killed his sister, Edna Bannister, because she felt she was in the way of her marriage to Oramel, end quote. Now, while Jane was plotting in Lowell, she actually had no idea that Minnie Gibbs' husband, as well as her father-in-law, Captain Gibbs, hired Massachusetts' leading toxicology expert, Leonard Wood, to investigate the deaths of his daughter-in-law and her family. She only learned that someone was finally onto her when she read it in the newspaper. As the bodies were being exhumed and examined, Jane was right away a person of interest, so State Police Detective John S. Patterson was assigned to watch her every move, preferably without her knowing. And Jane, perhaps being the egotistical narcissist that she was, didn't really think that they would find enough evidence to be able to pin the murders on her, so she was still going after Oramel and trying to seduce him into marrying her, but nothing she did was working. So she decided to, quote, poison him and nurse him back to health to prove how indispensable she was, end quote. When even this didn't work, Jane overdosed on morphine and tried to kill herself. But once she recovered, Oramel forced her out of his home, and with nowhere to turn, Jane decided to go visit her friend Sarah Nichols in New Hampshire on September 29th. Just a month later, on October 29th, police arrested Jane in Amherst, New Hampshire for the murder of Minnie Gibbs and was sent to the Barnstable jailhouse to await trial. Jane was still as conniving as ever and even went so far as to befriend the jailer's wife and convince her that she was innocent. The prosecution alleged that 44-year-old Jane Toppin used arsenic when she killed her victims because there was evidence of arsenic in the bodies. However, this was quickly ruled out because arsenic was actually used in the embalming fluid and would have been present regardless of whether or not it was the poison of choice. As the state tried to determine just how Jane murdered the Davises, Captain Gibbs actually had a light bulb moment and suggested that they look at morphine and atropine as a possible concoction that was used to poison them. But they needed more actual real evidence to connect Jane to the victims in order to move forward with the trial. With further investigation as well as, quote, an inquisition hearing about the deaths of the Davis girls, end quote, as well as the exhumations of Maddie and Alden Davis, investigators found that Captain Gibbs and his suspicions were actually correct. And on December 6th, Jane was officially charged with 4 counts of murder for the Davis family, and she pleaded not guilty. The trial was set to begin on June 23rd, 1902. In the months leading up to the trial, the newspapers had a field day with the case. On March 31st, it was reported, quote, that Jane had undergone a psychiatric evaluation by a panel of experts who had determined that she was insane. Jane admitted that she had an irresistible sexual impulse to kill, and she confessed to 11 murders, end quote. Now, I can't imagine that the legal system back then was as concerned about the influence of the media on cases like this, so it's plausible to think that the jury was definitely biased in their opinion of Jane Toppin and the crimes she committed before the trial started. I think in today's system, Jane's trial would have probably resulted in a mistrial because of this, although it's not entirely possible. I mean, just look at the case of Scott Peterson. Regardless of how you feel about him or the crimes he was convicted of, it's widely known that the jury was biased and interacted daily with the media, signing autographs, arranging book deals, reading and listening to reports on the case instead of being isolated and being able to listen to what they heard in the courtroom with an unbiased, open approach. On June 23, 1902, Jane Toppin's trial began and ended that same day. From start to finish, quote, it took less than 8 hours for the entire trial, and the jury only had to deliberate for 20 minutes. Jane was found not guilty by reason of insanity, end quote. The following day, Jane was sent to Taunton Insane Hospital for the remainder of her life and was openly very pleased with how the trial turned out. She believed that she would be able to convince the doctors at the hospital that she was well enough to return to society in just a matter of months. It turns out that Jane was even calculated in the way she would be convicted. After being found not guilty by reason of insanity, she confessed that she had committed more than 31 murders to her defense attorney, James Stewart Murphy, but that the number could be as high as 100. William Randolph Hearst, who owned the New York Journal, also had her typed up confession added to one of the journal's editions. In this statement, Jane, quote, admitted that she wanted the panel of psychiatrists to find her insane. Upon convincing them of this lie, she felt very smug in knowing that she had outsmarted a panel of experts. Jane described the exquisite pleasure it gave her to kill her patients, and she marveled at the lack of feeling and remorse she felt for doing these horrible things. In an attempt to show that she was not without feeling, Jane claimed that the jilt she received from the lover in her youth seemed to be the root of all her problems. Jane explained, "If I had been a married woman, I probably would not have killed all those people. I would have had my husband, my children, and my home to take up my mind," end quote. Despite Jane's belief that she would one day be released, she spent the next 35 years at Taunton, her mental health slowly declining. It even got to a point where she believed her food was being poisoned, so she refused to eat, but overall she was noted as mostly being a good patient. She never caused any real issues, although, quote, some attendants remember her calling them into her room and smiling, "Get some morphine, dearie," she said, "and we'll go out in the ward. You and I will have a lot of fun seeing them die," end quote. On August 17, 1938, at the age of 81, Jane Toppin passed away from natural causes. Alrighty friends, that was the case of Jane Toppin, a serial poisoner who killed her patients, despite being recommended by the doctors as one of their best nurses. She also manipulated her way into the homes of some of her victims and murdered them for what seemed like the sheer pleasure of watching another human being suffer as their life slipped away. Jane truly believed that she could do what she did and never get caught, but thankfully, other family members of her victims weren't as willing to believe that their loved ones died suddenly when they had been in good health. After her capture, she confessed how she, quote, sometimes got into bed with her victims as they convulsed from the poison, end quote. leading psychological experts to conclude that not only did she get pleasure from committing murder, but she also enjoyed the sexual thrill of the act, laying there in bed with her victims, holding them as they died in her arms. Jane has been on my list of killers to cover pretty much since I started this show back in January, and out of all the female killers I've covered, she scares me the most. There doesn't seem to be a really true reason for why she murdered who she did, other than the fact that she seemed to just enjoy killing. I know she said that if she hadn't been betrayed by her love at age 16, that if she had a family and a husband and a house to worry about, that she probably wouldn't have done this. I don't know if I entirely believe that, because she really did seem to just enjoy torturing other people. She wasn't killing anyone for an insurance payout. With the exception of her foster sister, Elizabeth, she wasn't killing anybody because she was in love with someone and needed the competition out of the way. Although, I'm not entirely sure that Elizabeth's husband, Oramel, was the main reason why she murdered Elizabeth and Oramel's sister. Jane, I think, associated Elizabeth's existence and her happy life with Jane's miserable ones at the hands of her foster mother. Perhaps her abuse as a child exacerbated the mischievousness that Jane displayed in school, and eventually, as an adult, she just wanted to cause others who were also in a helpless state pain, because she had experienced it when she felt helpless as a child. Jane was clearly an organized lust serial killer. She didn't come from a loving and understanding background, thanks to her foster mother, Anne Toppin. So she grew up without developing the coping mechanisms that would have given her the skills to deal with stress, frustration, or anxiety. And being an organized lust killer, they're often labeled as, quote, a troublemaker and a manipulator of people concerned only for himself, end quote, with an obvious expression of hostility, which I believe Jane definitely demonstrated during her active killing years. Her hostility was displayed, quote, through aggressive and seemingly senseless acts against society, end quote. The poisonings of those under her care or that she lived with, there was no real rhyme or reason, no motive other than wanting to cause physical harm to others for the sheer power and enjoyment of it. I think at the end of it all, Jane wanted to be feared. She wanted to feel powerful. She wanted to be able to be in control. And as a result, despite not having killed the most people ever out of all the serial killers ever, she is still viewed, quote, as quite a prolific killer who lived on in infamy, end quote. Alrighty, so that was Jane Toppin. Again, thank you to everyone who listens, who sends me suggestions, who participates, interacts with me on social media. I can't tell you how much I enjoy seeing your comments, your posts, any of the feedback that I get for whatever episode is always greatly appreciated. If you haven't had a chance, check out all the links in my episode notes. There's a link for the Oracle Network. There's also a link for my merch store, for my Patreon. There's the Linktree link that is in my bios on Instagram and Twitter. It's one consolidated link. It's actually really awesome. And if you click on it, it gives you the option to go to my merch store, the Patreon, my Ko-fi profile. If you'd like to do a one-time donation to the show, help me keep my caffeine addiction going. And just any kind of support is always greatly appreciated, whether it's participating on social media, sharing the episodes, telling friends about it, joining my Patreon, purchasing something from the merch store, anything at all. I am always so, so, so grateful, and I can't thank all of you enough for the continued support. it's just incredible. The support that you've given this show, it's been less than a year. It's only been, what, it hasn't even been 8 months that I've been doing this, but I am so grateful for everything. I without running the risk of sounding absolutely repetitive, you guys mean the world to me, and I love my listeners so much. Please stick around after the show for the promo trailer for the podcast Drink Drunk Dead. It's one of my new favorite shows. They go into spooky stories, paranormal, and then drink a little bit and try to scare each other. There is sarcasm, snark, a little bit of inappropriate humor, but I think it's hysterical, and some of the stories are actually pretty creepy. So go and give Emily and Joel a listen. I don't think you'll regret it. And as always, my resources are in the episode notes. Thank you all again so much for listening and supporting the show. Please join me next week when I cover Leonarda Cianciulli, Italy's very own soap maker of Correggio. Until next time, stay safe, friends. Mask of Sanity is partnered with the Oracle Network.
Obsessed with UFOs and extraterrestrials?
Convinced there's a chupacabra in your backyard?
Is your doppelganger ruining your life?
Do you love all things haunting related?
If you answered yes to any,
or none of these,
then these are the mostly sensical, slightly drunken ramblings for you? Question mark? I'm Emily.
And I'm Joel. We're the host of Drink Drunk Dead. Join us,
our two cats, Emma and Otto, and our house ghost,
every week as we have a few drinks, discuss all things paranormal,
and raise a toast
to our ghosts.